And now,
the definition. Definition.
It's a tragedy and a catastrophe that the left has accepted the idea of humans as historical products, simply reflections of their environment. Because what follows from that, of course, is that there's no moral barrier to molding them any way you like. I mean, if humans have no inner nature, if they don't have an inner instinct for freedom, you know, if it's not fundamental to their nature to have free, creative, productive work under their own control, if that's not part of their nature, then why, you know, there's no moral reason for allowing them that space. You could just mold them into being what you think they ought to be. And you can be the central committee, or you can be the managers of the corporation, or the directors of a fascist state, or whatever. And it's quite interesting that the modern intellectuals have moved in one or the other of those directions overwhelmingly. Either they're, and in fact, this was foretold in one of the, maybe the only prediction of the social sciences that ever came so dramatically true, was. Bakunin's discussion of this in the late 19th century. He was sort of arguing with Marx, and it's well before Leninism, but he predicted very perceptively that the rising class of intellectuals are just kind of becoming identified as a class in modern industrial societies. He predicted that they were essentially going to go in one of two directions. There would be some who would believe that the struggles of the working class would offer them an opportunity to rise and take state power in their own hands. And at that point, he said, they would become the red bureaucracy who would create the worst tyranny that humanity has ever known. Of course, all in the interests of the workers. That's one direction. And he said the others would recognize that you're never going to get power that way. And the way to get power is to associate yourself with what we would nowadays call state capitalism and just become the servants of its ruling class. And then you become the managers and the ideologues and so on for the state capitalist system. And as he put it, those people will beat the people with the people's stick. In other words, they'll talk about democracy, but they'll really be beating the people with the stick of democracy, which they'll turn into a mechanism of coercion. There's some who think you can get power by exploiting popular struggles, and there are others who see that you're going to get power by just associating yourself with the people who already have economic power and hence largely dominate. And I think that was a very accurate description of the century that followed him. This is 50 years before the Bolshevik Revolution, but he predicted its form very precisely and also its ideological background. And he also predicted quite accurately what happens in the modern state capitalist industrial societies. And looking at it now from the retrospect of 100 years, we can see this development very clearly. And it also explains an odd fact about 20th century intellectual life, namely how easy it's been for people to shift from one position to another. So the same person who's a Stalinist apologist 1 year is a super American patriot the next year, supporting every atrocity and working in the Hoover Institute and, you know, associated with most reactionary institutions. That transition, which sometimes is called the God that failed change, which was sort of authentic in the early years, like people like Simone and others, you know, there was something authentic about it. It became a joke. I mean, in fact, we're seeing it in Russia right now. The worst commissars are now the ones who are most passionate about the free market and investing and enriching yourself and so on. They've made the transition very easily, and that goes way back. And I think the reason is there's no transition. It's just a different estimate as to where power lies, but the same ideology. The ideology is you beat the people with the people's stick, and we're going to do it. And in fact, if you look at modern democratic theory in the West, it's remarkably similar to this. It's remarkably Leninist in its character. If you think of modern democratic, the leading tendencies in modern democratic theory in the West, so in academic world, it would be the strands of political science that developed from the thinking of people like Harold Lasswell and others, one of the founders of modern contemporary political science, and in the general sphere, the Wilsonian intellectuals, the so-called progressive intellectuals, of whom maybe Walter Lippmann was the most striking example in the United States, progressive intellectual in the 1920s, all of these people developed theories of democracy, and they're quite interesting. They're very Leninist in their character. The conception is that in a democracy there's two classes of citizens. There's the general public, who Lippmann calls ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, and Lasswell says they're too stupid to, we should not be overcome by dogmatisms about the common man who's too stupid to be able to do anything. That's the standard view. So there's these people, the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, which is maybe 90% of the population. And then there are the responsible men, the wise men, you know, the smart people, people with integrity and honor, the intellectual aristocracy, whatever you call them. And they have to rule. They're the ones who make the decisions, who do the thinking, and so on. And the role of the masses, the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, is just to show up every couple of years, decide which of the smart guys is going to be their leader, and then go home. Smart guys is going to be their leader, and then go home. Smart guys is going to be their leader, and then go home.
Entrepreneurship has largely been abandoned as a societal good, and the view of entrepreneurship, which is that it betters everybody. And capitalism is the great altruistic experiment in human history. This is where the right really goes wrong. When they talk about Schumpeter's creative destruction, that's a term that does not resonate with folks, because the truth is that capitalism is not about destruction. There may be things that get destroyed along the side, but that's not what capitalism is. Capitalism is the greatest altruistic experiment on behalf of tolerance and diversity in human history. There's a reason that the reason Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson is because he thought he could make money off of him. And when it comes to bringing new products to market, this is another distinction between left and right. The left would like for everybody to have a 1998 Nokia cell phone. The right would like for everybody at a certain point to have an iPhone 12. We're not going to get to the iPhone 12 if we keep removing the money from the folks who actually put up the money to create the iPhone 12 and all the people who compete with those people. The beautiful thing about capitalism as opposed to socialism, it is inherently altruistic. Capitalism is about the notion that if I don't give you something that you want, I will starve. Socialism is about the idea that if you don't give me something that I want, I will starve you. It's inherently selfish. So the idea that socialism is somehow some sort of great moral good is just a lie. Capitalism is the great moral good because it demands of you, of the individual. It's always easier to point the finger. Everybody else is responsible for making that guy's life better. But capitalism forces you at the point of starvation to go out and create for you and your family, and to make something better, not just for you and your family, but for the other person who you're dealing with. Voluntarism and the belief in opting in is the root and freedom. I mean, this is true freedom is capitalism. True tyranny is the socialistic state that we seem to be moving closer and closer to each and every day. Capitalism is about the notion that if I don't give you something that you want, I will starve. Socialism is about the idea that if you don't give me something that I want, I will starve you. It's inherently selfish. And capitalism is the great altruistic experiment in human history. Capitalism is the greatest altruistic experiment on behalf of tolerance and diversity in human history. The reason Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson is because he thought he could make money off of it.
And then there are the responsible men.
Capitalism is the great altruistic experiment in human history.
The wise men, you know.
Capitalism is about the notion that if I don't give you something that you want, I will starve.
The smart people, people with integrity and honor, the intellectual aristocracy, whatever you call them, and they have to rule.
True freedom is capitalism. True tyranny is the socialistic state that we seem to be moving closer and closer to each and every day.
Hello, this is Dee from Central New York. I just listened to your episode on Trump's budget. And it got me kind of thinking. The United States, I know people keep saying this, but I really do not believe we can understate this either. The United States presently is at a crossroads. It is in a lot more trouble than we like to think about the opioid addiction, the economic depression, which is very evident in just about every small and not so small community from coast to coast. The environmental catastrophe, the problems of government working for and by the people, all of these things, and probably a dozen others that I'm not mentioning, present a terrifying specter for the future. And the leadership is battling and fighting amongst itself old battles which have nothing to do with really building a better future for not only us, but those who came before us and those who will come after. So this got me thinking. Millennials are in a terrifying position right now. We have not been raised to take power. We have not been raised to be in power in a way that would completely redefine our future. Instead, we have been raised to be what Chris Hedges has called many times system managers, to basically maintain the status quo. Capitalism is a given. It's not to be challenged. It is to be continued, and it is to prevail into the future, is what we have been told. And many of us are uncomfortable with the idea that we see capitalism fail. We have not been put in the position to completely redefine our society. And this is the challenge of the age. Donald Trump is telling the millennials that we have to redefine our entire society. And we cannot do it in the same manner in which our parents did, in which our grandparents did, in which, well, I can't say our great-grandparents, because there is a lot of radicalism in them. But it presents us with a tremendous opportunity. And for many of us, this opportunity leads directly to the Democratic Party. But most of us, and I do mean most millennials, know the Democratic Party has no real solution and will present no real solution. What do we do then? We need to read up on the radicals of the late 1800s and of the early 1900s. Not necessarily to do as they did, but to learn from what they did.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother Vimir Deese. How you doing? This is the Class War Battlefield
podcast. First one of the year. You know, if I had my way, I have a grandiose vision for the Class War Battlefield podcast. Absolutely spectacular vision. And if I had my way, that would be what I'd produce in the coming months. I will not have my way. Not yet, anyway. And so, it'll be a mix. I don't know how many of you have been listening since the beginning, but before, I would do themed shows or shows with, not necessarily themes, but rich topics, and then I would utilize those topics to really debunk or explain away or explain a narrative. And that was actually what I designed the podcast to be for. Unfortunately, when I did this, I didn't publish in a predictable manner. And right now with the new format, whereas I would like to publish every single week, it's likely I would have to push it to every 2 weeks. Because of prep time and the fact that right now, it's really just me. So, but, you know, that's neither here nor there. And I'll have to do what I have to do to produce the quality show that I want to produce. I will still give commentary, but I also want to give updates. And I fought with myself on this because I'm a big fan of Economic Update with Richard Wolff, Dr. Wolff. And at the start of every one of his episodes, he does those type of updates. And I don't want to become that. I don't want to seem like I'm basically copying him. Because I'm not. But at the same time, I feel that there's information, there are stories which might be useful to you. Particularly as I speak about them from a bottom-up perspective. And a perspective that Mr. Wolff, though he is a very incredible economist and a man of very good integrity, may not be able to see or sense. So when I actually do unroll or reveal this new format, which is, I was thinking maybe February originally, but I might push it back to April or May, just to kind of give me some time to really perfect it and maybe think about getting a couple of contributors, things like that, you know. But anyway, I still want the themes, I still want to use clips, I still want to do some of the production stuff, but it will have multiple sections to it. It won't just be me talking to you, and I really want to build it around a new vision of creating community and creating the Commonwealth, because as I've spoken of many times before, I feel as if I'm looking at all of the information and indicators that America socially, even from an economic standpoint, is due for a major collapse. And I've talked many times about the spiritual kind of pivot that I've been doing. And I can tell you, family, I can tell you that on a very spiritual level, America is tired. It is losing momentum. It is losing the luster that has sustained it. And there is this underlying fear of realization that the party is over. That the way America has been living internally will not be sustained any longer, cannot be sustained any longer, and has led to a deep social psychosis, kind of this fragmented perception where reality is not being grasped entirely by whole segments of the population, which are spinning off into fantasy and illusion. And this is partially due to a culture of narcissism, which is, which really stems from a narcissistic attitude, not only among the elite, but among much of the general population of Americans. And I need to be very, very clear about this. This comes from Europe. And this is something that has traveled over here from Europe. And it has infected people who are not European. But this selfishness and inability to care for others, which is really at the heart of supposed rugged individualism, has left the country wanting. The nature of the country is in many aspects barbaric when it comes to caring for one's own. There is this deep disdain for nurture and the idea of nurturing. And so the social bonds, which would have really fed and groomed a generation to take active participation in politics and social structuring in a manner which would be traceable back 200 years. It'll be traceable back 200 years. Has been severed. And due to this severing, people are groping and grasping for a vision which they themselves barely can explain or accentuate. They can barely paint it accurately. And the few who can are mostly academics, and they are not connected well enough organizationally to the grassroots and to the levers of power or the communities and cooperatives necessary to build that vision. So they write grandiose books, they write papers, they write websites and blog posts and post videos and all of this great stuff about all of this that needs to be done. And yet, very little of it actually gets done. Because the people who need access to it don't have access to it. The academy is very good at separating and segregating itself from the general public. That's what sororities are for. That's what private clubs and institutional partnerships are for, to keep that information from seeping out into the general public's mind. Because look, these people saw what happened in the 60s when academia started really colliding with radical thought in the field. That was revolutionary. That was revolution, and those were revolutionary times. The wealthy do not want to enable that to happen again. So they've stopped that to the best of their ability. And that severing has left the generation groping. And in fact, it started in the 60s. That much of the radical classics, I remember Dr. King talking about this, they weren't read. They weren't studied thoroughly. And this actually was a weakness. This gave the underpinnings of the new movements very little legitimacy because they didn't have a foundation to stand on. And because they didn't have that foundation to stand on, they didn't have anything to root the new structures into. And that was a problem because those ideas, therefore, could literally be boxed in into the 60s and closed off from the public mind. Whereas capitalism in and of itself could say, well, look, we have 300 years of reference points where you can go back and you can dive into this energy. You can see this. This is big. This is great. This isn't, you know, pie in the sky, utopian, which is what many, many, many broadcasters used to refer to the ideas held by many of the young people in the 60s. These are utopian ideas. They're grand ideas, but they're not based on reality. And that's because they weren't rooted in anything. And many people frown at this. They scoff at this. You don't need to really do any real research into. When you root something, this is why, for instance, certain people are discouraged. I'll use Native Americans as a great example. When the Europeans came over and wanted to conquer them, what did they do? They said, you can no longer practice your traditional dances. You can no longer practice your traditional songs. You must stop speaking in your traditional tongues. Why? Because there's a power in that. There's an energy in that. That connects you for generations. And that is a sustainable life force. That's a sustainable life force. And so when you cut off a movement from other movements which were based on the same ideals and principles that you are trying to regenerate here, this is what made the Black Panthers very dangerous. This is what made Malcolm very dangerous, because both of these, well, the Panthers were a group, but they mandated reading. They said you must know. You must understand, because that's the power. When you don't have that, when you're not connected to those other cycles where those same ideas popped up and came in, your power is limited to the time in which you live, and that power can be extinguished and it can be dissipated. That is the danger of not connecting to history. That's the danger of not connecting to time. That is the problem. And since we are heading in the direction of incredible spiritual lag, since we are heading in the direction of incredible spiritual, I hate to use the phrase, I really hate to use the phrase because it sounds so dire, but we are heading in the direction of spiritual collapse. We are going to have to look for the lights which pointed through darkness before. And those lights do exist. We can go back to what was going on in the 1890s during that Great Depression, which was actually, as I understand it, bigger than the one in the 1930s. We can go back, the Wobblies and the persecution of Mother Jones and the persecution of black communities and all of these examples of dire suffering and we can read about it, and we can pray on it, and we can meditate on it, and that will give us strength to carry on, because that's what's going to be necessary. As we build up this new society, yes, I said it, a new society. As we build up a new society, we're going to have new vision, which is grounded in the past. And these things have been grounded in the past. And look, the reality is, for those of us who really, really, really want heaven on earth, who really believe that we can have a new, a new way to life, we're going to have to go through the conservatives. We're going to have to go through the people who are pessimistic and the people who don't believe anything good can ever come. And we're going to have to say, the hell with you. We know good things can come. And that's what we're going to have to build towards, is knowing that they can come. And that takes courage. That takes trust in the self. That takes trust in the mission. That takes trust in the essence of what you're doing. And that's difficult, because most of us have never been called on to do that. But we must do it. We must reach deep. We must say, this is our time. Now, I don't care if you're young. I don't care if you're old. I don't care if you're in between. This is your time. You know, I've mentioned it before, and I will mention it again this time, because it is just so powerfully right. Occupy Wall Street scared the living Christ out of these people on Wall Street and the elites all over the country. It scared them. Why? If I was to play devil's advocate and I was to say it was completely manufactured, that it was a government false flag operation, things like that, to kind of tag people who might be radicalized, might be agents of change and what have you, which some people have argued this. Some people have argued it. So let's say they're right. Why would it then scare the elite? And I use that term very loosely. It would scare the moneyed interest, because the reality is it grew extraordinarily fast. It started in September. It wasn't getting any kind of play. Then there was an incident. Now, here's what's funny. After that incident, it still didn't grow that quickly. There were a couple of other Occupy spots, but it didn't grow that quickly. And by the way, it's, you know, I should mention, because it kind of plays into me playing the devil's advocate here. There was a group of people who were meeting in Washington, D.C. at the same time Occupy Wall Street started, and they were demanding change, economic change. And it was kind of suggested that Occupy Wall Street was started to cut that real movement off. Maybe. I can't say for sure. What I can say is that incident happened and things didn't really grow that quickly. But then in October, as the progressive media picked it up, and this is when I really started seeing the power in the progressive media, if they would get their act together and put their egos aside. But the progressives, well, most of them, are useless, because they are just conservatives pretending to have a conscience so they can make money. Some of them, not all of them. And don't rest assured that when I say some of them, not all of them, that you are the sum of them. Or excuse me, that you are the not all of them. because you are probably the sum of them. But as the progressive media picked it up, and this is, I give credit to even Keith Olbermann for this, because Keith Olbermann did do this, and when he wasn't on MSNBC then, he was on Current TV. And they started talking about this. They started pushing it. Our website started pushing it. And it started growing. It went from New York City and Washington and Oakland and, you know, major cities to suddenly it was 2,000 locations by, I think it was the end of October. 2,000 locations. And then it started popping up all over the world. This scared the Jesus out of these people. Why? Because if it was manufactured by the government, and it's completely plausible, it could have been. It is more likely that they said, not many people are going to participate. We have these people thoroughly immunized from radicalism. They're not going to really get active. They're just going to be there. And what they saw was their thinking was wrong. What they saw was their thinking was wrong. And that people were waiting to see other people stand up. And this is why I tell you, when Black Lives Matter started rising, they infiltrated it quickly and they made it appear nonviolent. Or excuse me, not nonviolent. They made it appear violent. They had to. Because they saw what happened with Occupy. When Occupy Wall Street was proven, it was nonviolent 100%. It was proven to be nonviolent. It spread like wildfire. And by the way, I didn't use that mistakenly, because trust me when I tell you that these fires in California, they're just the beginning. This is a spiritual manifestation, or excuse me, a physical manifestation of a spiritual energy that is not being allowed to be expressed. So it is causing the planet to warm. I know it sounds crazy. I don't care. This is a spiritual reality that I'm telling you about right here. But shifting back to Occupy Wall Street, they saw this. They saw the numbers. They saw what was going on Twitter, what was going on Facebook, what was going on everywhere. And they realized that even though their conservative lapdogs were crushing this thing, even MSNBC didn't treat it like they should have to be a progressive media outlet. Even though their liberal and conservative lapdogs were beating this thing and saying it was horrible, it was disgusting. I'm talking about from all levels. They were hating Occupy Wall Street. Even though they were doing it, guess what? It didn't matter. People were coming out. I remember a picture of a group of like 20 people in the middle of nowhere calling themselves Occupy some small town in the middle of the West. This scared the Jesus out of these people, just scared them. And not only did Occupy Wall Street scare them, because look, the wealthy aren't stupid. They're not going to overreact just because, oh, there's a bunch of people out here. It was what came with Occupy Wall Street. That letter campaign, I know most of you probably don't remember it now, but a guy posted a video on YouTube, and it went viral, where he said, you know, we're all trying to hit the banks today to make them feel it so that they'll stop sending us crap. Well, they send you these envelopes, which are postage paid. You can send it back to them and they have to pay a little bit. But if you add things to it that'll weigh it down, they'll have to pay more. And people started doing it. People started doing it. People started going to banks and pulling money out, withdrawing money out to put it in community banks, federal credit unions, in community banks. People started doing it. There was a wealth transfer of billions of dollars in a couple of weeks from banks, which got bailed out, to community banks. People were doing this. And the wealthy became frightened. And the wealthy became frightened. No one's actually done this research, but everyone's kind of knocked Barack Obama for signing that defense authorization bill at the end of 2011 with that passage which allows them to, I think, kidnap American-born. I hate to say it, but I kind of, there's so many of those things that I'm going to probably get this wrong. But it basically allows, I think it allows federal troops pretty much on the streets, and they can hold American citizens without due process, all kinds of craziness. But people knock him for signing that. But in the years since he signed that, it's been 6 years, over 6 years. I haven't read where anyone's actually looked at when that provision was added. Because the defense authorization bill happens every year, but no one has actually said, okay, was this added after Occupy Wall Street started, or was it added before Occupy Wall Street started? Why would that be important? Because if it was added after Occupy Wall Street started, and truthfully, that's what I believe. I wonder if it was added after Occupy Wall Street was started. I wonder that. Now, it might have been added before. Absolutely. But if it was added after, let's say it was added sometime in October, what does that say? That proves my theory that they were afraid. That they were afraid and that they said, we need to do something. We need to have some major power. We have to have some major power in this country that's going to crack the heads of these people if they start to even think that they're going to move towards egalitarianism. Yeah, I'll say it again, egalitarianism, commonwealth. If they believe they're going to do that, we need to have something that we can knock them with. Now listen, family, everyone got up in arms with Barack Obama about that. But do you understand that there's actually a history of that? This is another bit of knowing your history. Do you get that there's a history of this? If you can find it, it's difficult, but I think it's still on YouTube. Plutocracy, Part 1 and 2, from Meganoia. You don't have to type in Meganoia. You can just type in Plutocracy, Roman numeral 1, and Plutocracy, Roman numeral 2. And if you don't know what the Roman numeral is, may I just say, what are they teaching you kids in the freaking schools? And then, it's an I. So, Roman numeral 1 would be an I, Roman numeral 2 would be two I's, and they have to be capitalized, even though I don't know if YouTube cares. But great, great video on the labor wars in the United States. Great videos. But you can only find them in like small quality. I mean, they're still good. Watch them. Small quality on YouTube, but they're still good. Anyway, people talk about, and especially the right wing, oh, we need our, Second Amendment rights. We need our Second Amendment rights. Yes, you do. But what do you need them for? The idea of having a well-regulated militia wasn't for the benefit of the country. It was for the benefit of the plutocracy and the rich, who often called out the local militia to put down strikers. Hear me. Hear me. Hear me. Please hear what I just said. They would call out the militia to put down strikers. They would not only call out the militia to put down strikers, they would call out the militia pure and simple, to put down people who they deemed a threat to their wealth. So if they thought that they had a union organizer, or if they knew they had a union organizer, they'd call out some of the militiamen to kill, beat, and maim that union organizer. They might start with, okay, we're going to try to bribe them. And then we're going to beat him up. And then he ain't getting the message. Now we might kill one of his family members. And then he still ain't getting the message. Now we're going to kill him. Or we might kill his dog. This is what the militia was for. So you need to understand that there's always been this divide. And it ain't about this crap left and right. This is a vision for America. And God, I hate to say it because it sounds like a Civil War talk. But this is what it's always been about. It's about the feudal peasants who want to remain feudal peasants. As long as they get to exercise the power of the crown against their other feudal peasants who don't want to remain feudal peasants, they're happy. They're happy. And some of these feudal peasants get raised up to the level of pseudo-nobility. You know, that's the middle-class police officers. That's the middle-class firemen. That's the middle-class middle managers. That's the middle-class. And so they support the oligarch. They support the kings and the queens. Now, this is history. This is history. This is why it's important to know your history and to know it from a radical standpoint. Because once you know it from a radical standpoint, and I ain't talking about, oh, well, you gotta know it from Marx. No, you gotta see the root. Not just the information, the root, because it's telling you something. It's telling you something. And we have gotten away from reading history to learn lessons and to see a broader picture. So I know people who can read and recite a million facts about history. But when I say to them, okay, what is the bigger picture of that million facts? What does it tell you? They can't tell me. They cannot tell me. The plutocratic way of organizing the United States presently with the middle class, and not even presently, I'm talking, I really should say, back then and today, with the middle managers and then the peasant militiamen. All of this goes back to the feudal caste, C-A-S-T-E, caste system of Europe. And that is what the South, the Confederacy, fought to keep. They wanted that caste system to remain intact. But here's the funny part. So didn't the North. I ain't getting into it, but so didn't the North. So the vision for the United States has always been about one of democracy. People who wanted the freedom for democracy and enlightenment and commonwealth. The power to use the will force of the individual collectively. Hear me again. The power to use the will force individually, collectively. Individually, collectively. You can do both. It's an enlightened attitude and it's an enlightened soul, but you can act individually towards the collective. It can be done. But you got to remove the impediment of acting collectively. And the only way you do that is you remove greed. You remove greed. And there's people who tell you, you can't remove greed. It's part of the human nature. It's part of the human condition. It's bred into us because we live in a world which believes it is a world of lack. It's not true. You had those people who wanted democracy and enlightenment and commonwealth. And equally, you had those people who wanted the exact opposite. opposite. And I don't even know how to explain it anymore. Because it's not that they were the counter-enlightenment, because it really wasn't that. And I know people like to say it's that, but it wasn't counter-enlightenment. It wasn't counter-democracy. These people believed that the only way to really structure a society is hierarchically. That's the only way. And authoritative government is the best way to do it. And what's funny is conservatives want that. If you watch what they're doing, everything they do, everything they advance, everything they advocate is always for authoritarian rule. There is not one instance where it doesn't move in that direction. They are not for enlightenment. They are not for enlightenment. In fact, they're more for superstition and kind of, they want a certain small group of people to hold the information and then the rest of the people to follow that group of people. And this is what you've always had. You've always had this. And so there's always been two visions in this country for how things should be built. Should it be done the old way? Should it be done the new way? And when the oligarchs called up the militia, the people who they got believed in this other vision. And now, I remember, you know, the whole reason why I brought up all of this before I got into, you know, the broader discussion was I connected it to Obama signing that bill. People have to understand that what Obama did, what he made legal, was legal 100 years prior. And I'm not even sure if it was made illegal at any time. Probably was, because they kind of stopped doing it. But he made legal. Why? He made legal what was once very legal. Why is this important? Because, again, know your history. Cyclical, 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 cyclical. These people aren't playing new tunes. They're playing old ones. And the problem is that they know it's old music. They know it's old music, and they've been acting as if this is all new. I guarantee, you know, with all of the people, all of the smart people in television, in media, in radio, on the internet, I guarantee there's people with enough degrees where they understand that this has happened before and that this is nothing new. And so therefore, it is their job. I don't have the resources that most of these people have yet. I don't have the resources yet. It's their job to tell you the future by what has happened in the past and to tell you what you should be doing. Because there's a blueprint. How many of you know about the social gospel? This is something massively important. Every church that considers itself part of the enlightened group. Oh, I'm a social justice warrior. How about you be a social gospel warrior? Because that changes how you look at the Bible. That changes how you look at your fellow man. And that even changes how you approach things like women's rights, civil rights, black rights. It changes how you look at a lot of things. But most of you don't know about that. How many people know about the argument about the Commonwealth that took place in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, and 80s that took place both in Europe and the United States on what the idea of Commonwealth even was? I know briefly about it. I found books on it. We don't even talk about Commonwealth anymore because it's considered just beyond the mind, man. You can't talk about that. Commonwealth? What are you, a socialist? Yes, I'm a socialist. Why the heck aren't you? Socialism is evil. You did the USSR. Okay, the USSR. One type of socialism. Not a good one either. Very right wing. Had no... Well, it did, actually. It had some tendencies of socialism, but it was very authoritative socialism. It wasn't social democratic, which is completely different. See, everybody, you know, I'm finding out, there are, and it shouldn't be this way, but this is just the realm that we live in, I guess, but when you say something like communism, people have many different things in their mind. But if you say socialistic communism, that's different. Then if you say authoritarian communism, that's different. If you say democratic authoritarianism, that's very different than if you say authoritarian democracy. Very different. You say social democratic, very different than if you say democratic socialism. Very, well, somewhat different. That's actually one case where I think it might not be very different. But two words to describe something. So we live in a capitalistic democracy. Mm-hmm. Now, I truthfully don't believe there's a such thing as a democratic capitalist or a democratic capitalism. I don't believe that's even possible. And truthfully, I'm not sure if you can have democracy in a capitalistic society anyway. I think, truthfully, what we call democracy is not democracy. I think it's what the elite tells us democracy is. And if we were to really look at what democracy was, yeah, the United States would fail miserably. But adding one more word describes a lot. And that's why we rarely do it. That's why the elite rarely allow it to happen. Because if you could actually describe what something is by just doing that, it changes communication between us. I'll give you a great example of this. A great example. I'm going to say a word. I want you to think. When I say the word, what immediately pops into your head? Ready? Here goes. Water. How many of you pictured a glass of water? I bet you most of you probably pictured a glass of water. Or maybe you were standing next to a pool. Or you were just gotten out of a pool, so you're going to picture the pool. Or maybe an ocean. Most of us, though, are going to picture clean water. Because that's what we want water to be. That's what we want water to be. We live in the United States where clean water is plentiful. Imagine if you lived in another country where clean water was not plentiful. Someone says water. That's going to give you a different connotation. You're going to respond differently to it. What I'm saying is preconceived notions and expectations blind us sometimes to the reality of something. We think of most likely drinkable water, when we think of water. It's the same thing with democracy. We think of what democracy should be like, not what it is. We think of our expectations of democracy, not what it is. And that's easy, because if you actually had to look at what something is, the news, by the way, did this very well with populism, right-wing populism. Mind you, they never talk about left-wing populism, because right-wing populism is unrealistic. But if we think of what something actually is, then guess what? We might have to grow to meet it. We might have to grow to meet it. And democracy is one of those things where if you look at what it actually is, if you really sit down and you meditate, I'm talking about meditate. I'm not talking about getting stuck in the ego. Going beyond that. To that place where everybody's soul comes together in the upper conscious sphere of this planet. And if we meditate on it, we will see democracy is something vastly different than what we believe it is. And we will realize that we will have to grow to meet it. Because democracy is all-encompassing. Hear me. It's all-encompassing. It is cultural as well as political. It is economic as well as social. It is all-encompassing. You cannot have democracy in a country where its primary economic engine is authoritarian. And that's what corporations are. They are authoritarian. That's what they're built to be. Massively, rigidly hierarchical. You can't have it. It does not work. But to confront that reality to confront that truth and to make it a reality takes a lot of energy. Takes a lot of maturity, takes a lot of maturation, and most of us ain't ready for that. So we imagine what democracy should be, what we expect it to be. And truthfully, most of our expectations are wrong because we have been fed them all our lives. They are not even connected to the reality of what democracy is. We connect our expectations of democracy to capitalism, and that's because we have been forced to believe that capitalism was similar to and the same as democracy. It is not. I give credit to conservatives because conservatives will tell you straight up, this ain't no democracy. This is a republic. It's capitalist. It ain't never going to be no democracy if we can help it. Conservatives will tell you that. I've had conservatives tell me that. And at first when I was educatedly stupid, and I mean that in the most unpolite way, when I was educatedly stupid, woo, I argued with them, how can you say this isn't a democracy? They were right. This isn't no democracy. It's not meant to be a democracy. You can't have caste. You cannot have caste in a democracy. And that's what we have. We have caste. I know. I call this Class War Battlefield Podcast. I thought about for a while. I'm not joking when I say this. I really honestly thought about changing this to Caste War. Because we need to be concentrating on caste as well as class. Because oftentimes both sides of that war, that vision war that's going on, they're both thinking about their caste position. This is why so many of the racial problems don't go away. Because it's about caste. And everybody wants to be at an advantage for their caste. Their caste. This isn't a democracy. This is not a commonwealth. And I hate to tell you. I really hate to tell you. I know the Brits believe differently. The Brits believe you can have a commonwealth without democracy. You can't. You cannot. You cannot. And this is why the Brits are going to experience some social problems of their own. You cannot have a social commonwealth without a democracy. You cannot have it. But to really live up to democracy, you gotta mature. And most of us ain't ready for it. But there's a blueprint. There's blueprints. We have to look back into history, but there are blueprints. Oh, there are blueprints. And this is really the message of today's program. There are blueprints. And we're going to have to get back in touch with some of those radical blueprints, because those blueprints are really going to be what saves us. And I'm not just talking about, you know, finding strength to get through the hard times, because those times are coming. But we have to find strength to build better, to erect better, to construct better, to be better. And I hate to tell you, but you're going to have to look in a lot of radical places to do that. Now, this also speaks to the lacking of democracy in this country, too, because the reality is we talk constantly about a free and open press, but guess what? We don't have radical newspapers anymore. And the few that we do have, they're limited. You can't find them a lot of places. You do not have one labor paper in major supermarkets, major stores, major gas stations. You don't have labor papers. Why? Because that's a threat to capitalism. So if this was democracy, if this was a democracy, if this was democracy, all day long, this was a democracy, it wouldn't matter the economic threat, because the economy would be based on democracy. But the economy is based on capitalism, so therefore, that is a threat. They can't allow it to escape. They can't allow it to be inserted. They can't allow it to happen. They can't. Ooh. I mean, it's... they can't allow it. So this isn't a democracy, and we need to understand that. Now, I want to touch quickly on, again, this idea, because we have lost, I think, the idea that there is a blueprint. And the radical books, and actually, the radical books that we need to be reading, you know, I was looking up Emma Goldman, and I've mentioned her before. And I was blessed. I was really blessed a few years ago. I went on a, what I like to call a downloading spree. LibriVox. And I've mentioned them before. And I found an incredible collection of essays from Emma Goldman. Read by somebody, I think they were in Britain. And I downloaded them. And I downloaded a bunch of PDFs, which I don't have many of those anymore. Unfortunately, they were on a external hard drive that got ruined, so I don't have those. But I downloaded a bunch of them, and I downloaded a bunch of books, a lot on social gospel, books, digital books from radical labor organizers and radicals altogether, just, you know, people who were really in the struggle to make things right and bright and better. And what I found, first and foremost, is a lot of those books have disappeared. You can't find them online much anymore. And I believe this is deliberate. There's a lot that you can find. And thankfully, there's people who are now resurrecting some of those things. I found it more difficult 2.5 years ago to find some of those books than I am finding it now. There's a lot more available books online. So there's blueprints. There's blueprints. And I would truthfully say, and I know this could get some people in trouble, there's a website, I think it's called, well, I don't know what the website's called, but it's if you Google Marx Archive, there is an incredible array of principled guidelines and principled books of political economy, social economy, all kinds of things that mostly about economics that you could find on this website, this archive, and it will enlighten you to at least what was going on back then. It'll give you some ideas of how to kind of start approaching a critical analysis of capitalism. And it'll give you kind of a different view on capitalism. So if you're not afraid to be challenged, I'm not saying everything that they write is correct, and I'm not saying even that I agree with Marxism, but I am saying that it's something beneficial. That'll do. Thank you for listening. Thank you for giving me some of your time. I hope to have that new formatted podcast to you very soon, very shortly. Until then, you know, contact me, of course, at the email address above. Contact me, let me know if you have any questions, comments, concerns. I always love hearing from you. And let me know. If there's anything that I could talk about that you want to know about, alright? This is your brother, Vladimir Deese. I love all of you. Peace to you. Peace to your families. And be prepared. Movement's on. Till next time. Peace.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments are killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or